Hi guys, I'm Dana Al-Hanbali, and this is Something to Consider. Today, we have the honor of speaking to Steve Sosaby, a true humanitarian and advocate for Palestinian rights. Born and raised in Ohio, Steve's journey as a journalist in the Middle East ignited his passion for helping children affected by conflict and lack of medical care. In 1991, he founded and built PCRF, the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, with a vision to provide hope and healing to children in the region, regardless of their background. Steve's leadership propelled PCRF into a globally recognized nonprofit, touching countless lives with vital medical treatment and humanitarian aid that is supported by his global network of medical professionals, volunteers, and the generosity of people's donations. Through the organization, they have established pediatric cancer centers, PICUs, and pediatric cardiology departments, among other critical healthcare infrastructure in Palestine. In light of the genocide that has been unfolding in Palestine since October 2023, Steve has since left PCRF to start HEAL, a nonprofit organization that is geared at addressing the broader challenges that Gaza and the rest of Palestine is and will be facing in the future as a result of the current humanitarian catastrophe. Steve, thank you for all that you have done and all that you continue to do for Palestine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Absolutely. The privilege is all ours. Before we get into HEAL, I'd love to give the audience a little bit of context about you. What brought you to Palestine and what made you stay and dedicate your life to the cause?
Well, my story of serving Palestine and getting started in Palestine begins in the First Intifada, when I was a university student in a small town in Ohio and was involved in social justice movements. There was something called the Progressive Student Network back then, and it was a coalition of student activists who were involved in a lot of social justice issues. And the First Intifada began, and I was very much moved by the courage and the struggle of the young people in Palestine, people my age, who were in the streets, most of them nonviolently trying to resist occupation and free themselves, something I never had to do in my life, although at that time, a significant number of people around the world were struggling for freedom. I was raised always to support and serve the cause of justice and freedom, particularly with the privilege that I was born with. I always say, you know, I've kind of hit the jackpot in life being born a white American male. That comes with, not only that is the most privileged specimen in the history of the world, it's also with a huge amount of responsibility that comes first to recognizing your privilege and then standing with and serving causes of justice and freedom around the world. When the Palestinian uprising began, I wanted to educate American students about the issue from a kind of a general political sense, as what it meant from a colonial perspective, the Palestinians themselves being uprooted from their land and so on. And as I got involved in the issue, by chance, I got selected to go to visit the West Bank and Gaza during the first year of the First Intifada as a college student, part of a student delegation through the area. ADC was doing something called Eyewitness Israel, which was a great program. And having gone there during winter break of 1988, I saw firsthand and experienced firsthand living in the homes of Palestinians in Gaza, in Hebron, in Ramallah, in Jerusalem. Firsthand saw what occupation looked like, what it felt like, but also the resilience, the kindness, and the hospitality of the Palestinian people. I went back and finished my degree in international relations, went back to work in Palestine as a journalist, wanting to share stories of the people I met and trying to educate Americans about what was happening on the ground there. And in the course of working as a journalist, I started to meet injured children who need medical care they could not get locally. So I started arranging treatment for children who were injured and needed care, and I was able to find care for them for free in American hospitals. And that's how I started. I just started placing kids in hospitals, working with our communities all over the United States, organizing treatment for children, and then bringing them, getting them care, and sending them back to their families. In the course of that, I decided to start an organization called Palestine Children's Relief Fund to facilitate this work, PCRF. And that's how we got started. And then I met my first wife, who was Palestinian, got married, and together we built the organization with the help of a lot of other people.
That's so incredible. It's incredible also to hear about how, in this specific case, and probably in many more cases, all it takes is making a choice to help, and then the rest kind of finds a way to happen. Could you highlight some of the most impactful maybe projects or initiatives that came out of PCRF early on?
Oh, there's so many of them. Early on, well, our main focus was always bringing kids and getting them treatment. And then as our organization grew and expanded, we started sending volunteer medical teams there, organizing volunteer physicians from all over the world to go and provide specialized medical care and treatment for children on the ground. And that was really, we're the first organization to do that. And we found a huge response of doctors. Now it's a lot of organizations are doing it, but we found a huge response of volunteers who were interested and keen to put their time and effort into operating on children and training local doctors. And as the organization grew, we really started taking on more and more programs and projects until we, I mean, I'll leave the rest of it for your question, but that was the early on success, was bringing hundreds and then thousands of kids out for free medical care and then sending hundreds and then thousands of doctors there to operate and volunteer.
That's incredible. When it comes to finding the volunteers, though, did you face any issues or struggles with people wanting to opt into programs like this?
Not really. I mean, what we found is that as soon as a doctor would go there and get past that kind of mental blockage or fear and concern, which is kind of natural as a result of the way the issue is portrayed, they always wanted to go back. Mm-hmm. So we had doctors who would go every 6 weeks or every 6 months or once a year, whenever they would find the time in their schedule, they would volunteer and come back. And we had doctors coming 20, 30, 40, 50 times and operating on kids by the thousands eventually. And it was a remarkable opportunity for them to serve, but it also expanded the network because as they came back into their hospitals or into their communities or their societies, their associations, they would spread the word about the work that was needed on the ground and also the organization that was sponsoring them and making a very professional and safe experience for them.
In terms of PCRF was very, very focused on getting children the medical care that they needed outside of Palestine. Right now, if we were to kind of look at how you've built or how you are building HEAL, there's a significant change in focus and almost more of a broader initiative in terms of how you'd like to tackle help in Palestine. Why make such a significant shift? What are you seeing now that is necessary that goes beyond the medical facilitation?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a genocide in Gaza. We're seeing a complete destruction of an entire society, the Gazan society, part of the Palestinian society. 2.4 million people have had their entire lives uprooted, destroyed in many cases. Huge numbers of children with significant and permanent injuries, an entire generation traumatized and going to be suffering significant psychological trauma for the rest of their lives. An entire society destroyed infrastructure-wise, but also lives have been destroyed. And I feel with 30 plus years of experience on the ground, building PCRF, running PCRF is into one of the most successful organizations with the help and support of so many thousands of volunteers all over the world. It was time for me to take on a bigger challenge. And while I will continue the same work in the health sector, which is, I'm the one that built those programs in PCRF, I think HEAL will continue those. But I also think we need to take on a broader focus when it comes to other areas that really need the kind of attention that I've learned to develop. And I think the most effective way that we can really impact the lives of the Palestinians is to use the talent and skills that are available in the international community on a volunteer basis. There's people in every background, in every walk of life, and that's where PCRF was successful. As I mentioned, we had literally thousands of volunteer doctors and nurses from all over the world who gave their time to come and build our health programs, which resulted in huge success. We can do the same in other areas as well. It's just a matter of organizing and building an organization that can facilitate that kind of work.
I love the fact that HEAL, aside from it being a powerful term, HEAL Palestine, it's an acronym that stands for Healthcare, Education, Aid, and Leadership. Can you talk to us a little bit about the choices behind each of these verticals and what are the objectives of each one?
Sure. So the first, obviously, H for HEAL, and I mentioned, or for health, excuse me. I mentioned that briefly that a lot of the work we're doing is to, and our goal was, and actually, let me take a step back just briefly. Before October 7th, what I was doing on the ground in Gaza and in the West Bank with our medical advisory board, with literally hundreds of doctors who had firsthand experience and nurses, firsthand experience on the ground in Palestine, was for them to do needs assessments and identify areas in their specialization where we could identify gaps and deficiencies in the health sector, particularly related to patient care, that we could address, improve upon, and reduce both the suffering of children and the need for sending them abroad for care. So we had about 43 different committees and subcommittees and different specializations where we were actively working to improve the quality of care in neurosurgery, pediatric neurosurgery, cardiac surgery, pediatric cardiac surgery, pediatric surgery, general surgery, plastic reconstructive surgery, so on and so forth. We were identifying gaps in areas that we could either train local doctors, provide equipment or infrastructure, medicine, missions that would go and fill the gaps and reduce the waiting costs. So that's the kind of work that I started with PCRF and we were actively working on before October 7th, and we'll continue to do in HEAL. We have a health advisory board of many of the same doctors who came over and wanted to continue the work with me. In addition to that, we have obviously to respond to what the needs are on the ground when we're talking about health. And the needs right now is that there's literally thousands of children who are not getting adequate medical care, who've suffered traumatic injuries in the past 4 months, that need to go outside for treatment because the health system inside Gaza has completely collapsed. That's something that we can do now and are doing now. We've already gotten kids out. In addition to that, we have to think about the next phase when it comes time to rebuild the health sector in Gaza. That's going to take a huge amount of resources and efforts on the part of everyone. And we need to be somebody who's been on the ground for over 30 years in the health sector in Gaza, we have a very significant role to play in that. And then obviously building up services that are based on what the needs are. We know, as I mentioned previously, the entire population is traumatized. So what do we do in the issue of mental health services to address this significant issue of children in particular who are suffering from psychological trauma? How can we help them, for example? And then there's so many other areas and needs that are on the ground that we need to work on and address when it comes to health. When it comes to education, the entire academic year is lost. All of the children, all of the grad students, all of the high school students, all of the university students in Gaza are missing this year and may miss next. No one knows what the future is, but we do know that the impact of children not going to school and young people in particular missing an entire academic year is significant for them from an educational point of view, from a developmental point of view, and from an opportunity point of view. These kids have to compete. They have to become independent. They have to survive on the global marketplace and be able to gainfully be employed and be able to take care of themselves. That's our goals and objectives. And by them being denied a year of education and possibly more than that, this is going to significantly impact our ability and the ability in general for Palestinian society and Gazan society to be rebuilt. So the need in education is overwhelming, and we need to play a role in that. And there's so many opportunities and resources available globally, both within our community of Palestinians in the diaspora and Arabs in the diaspora who can play a significant role in guiding and leading this process. There's huge, huge amounts of needs and also huge opportunities for us to come in and have a positive impact. In the area of A for aid, obviously this is related to what the needs are on the ground. Right now we're seeing significant areas of hunger and even starvation in Gaza, and we're doing massive food distributions right now, purchasing from the local market, importing when we can through Egypt, empowering young people to cook food and distribute it and give them opportunities to have some form of employment, but more importantly, feed people who are going without food, going without shelter. We're building shelters on the ground in Gaza. We're bringing in tents. Whatever we can do to address the urgent acute crisis, which is, you know, overwhelming right now in Gaza, we're doing our best to work on that area. And as we move forward in the future in the area of aid and that we will continue to address what the needs are on the ground, particularly in the area of empowering and young people to be part of this aid relief program. The people in Gaza, the young people in Gaza, all very much want to help support and be part of any effort that's going to serve their people. And we need to give them the resources and opportunities to lead this and be part of it. And the final one is leadership, which is very significant. This is kind of leadership / mentorship. And in the area of leadership, we feel that there's a great opportunity to, first of all, develop a brand new generation of young people who can be taught and guided how to become leaders in their communities to solve problems that otherwise are going to go unsolved, give them opportunities to train them and teach them how to build organizations that can take on social, economic, and other issues in their communities that otherwise will be neglected. Give them training and expertise and experience and even seed money to develop organizations locally that can take on social issues that I think would be give them opportunities also to develop leadership skills that then can move forward and take on bigger challenges that are extreme in Gaza. And the mentorship part of the leadership program is that, frankly, we have 30,000 injured children in Gaza right now, and probably that number is going to be much greater when this genocide is finally over. God willing, tomorrow. And the need for, I think right now, nobody is really talking about what is the future for these children. Who's going to come in and rebuild the lives of Gaza's children? Everyone's talking about rebuilding Gaza, but they're talking about the physical structures. They're talking about the infrastructure and the buildings and the hospitals and the schools, which need to be rebuilt. And hopefully the, you know, everybody will understand that has to be done quickly, and the resources available from governments should be focused to rebuild Gaza. But the responsibility of rebuilding the lives that have been destroyed and shattered over the past 4 months of young people in particular in Gaza is our responsibility, is the responsibility of the Palestinian community outside, one of the most talented, developed, experienced, and capable diaspora communities in the world. There's no reason why the Palestinian community and the Arab community and those of us who stand with the Palestinian people in their struggle for freedom cannot put together a platform and a program and an initiative that takes responsibility for the lives of every one of these children and helps guide them through the course of recovery, whether that is a physical recovery, whether that is a social mental health recovery, and then provides them opportunities to have a fruitful future through education, through mentorship, through training, through vocational support, whatever it is that we can get these kids independent and give them an opportunity to have a meaningful life and a meaningful future. We have those skills and the abilities in our diaspora community by the millions. We're willing to do it. And by the way, it's not just Palestinians, although it certainly is a Palestinian cause and one that which the Palestinians should lead this process. But more importantly, you have literally tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of people all over the world who are standing with the Palestinian people right now. We need to harness and garner that support into something meaningful and constructive. It's not enough to just be marching in the streets, although that's important, and I do that as well. But we need to also use that energy into something that's going to have a long-term impact, particularly in repairing and healing the lives of these children. That's our goal, and heal Palestine. That's why I decided to move on from PCRF and start a new organization. And I'm very passionate about having an opportunity to serve this cause on a greater level.
I think that's so incredibly well said. And I think one of the things that I don't even know if I should continue to call them the diaspora community, the exile community, the community of Palestinians that are educated and are accomplishing all of these things outside Palestine. I think that one of the results of this systemic oppression over the past 75 plus years is this illusion that we don't have an active role to play in Palestine, even if we're not physically there, which is completely untrue. And what I love about what you've built with HEAL and your network and the breadth of your initiatives is that you've opened the door to us to start talking about how can we actually connect as a community to each other and give back and contribute. There's a lot of work to be done and we have a role to play. What role do you think international organizations and potentially governments can play in what it is that you are trying to build? Or do you feel like a lot of it should be focused on a lot of these empowerment micro initiatives that you're doing within HEAL?
That's a great question. And I haven't probably thought enough about what the role of large INGOs would have in this initiative. Traditionally, I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years. I see 30 years, I've seen very well the role that large organizations and large institutions have had in Palestine. And while they have the tremendous resources, they're not always the most efficient and the effective in how they utilize those resources. The one thing that how I built PCRF initially with the support of so many people is to be very efficient and very effective in the way that its resources were utilized. And I'm very proud of that. And I always wanted to get away from being a donor organization where, you know, we're just giving money to other organizations to do the work that we could do more effectively and more efficiently. And I always believe strongly that we can build better models. And I'm happy to work with any organization, anybody who shares the same values and vision, but I'm not going to allow this initiative to be bogged down with bureaucracy and take away from what our greatest goal and vision is, which is to directly help those in need right now. If large organizations want to be part of it, they're perfectly welcome, but I'm not sure what their role would be when it comes to the actual implementation of these programs. We want to share resources. We want to learn from people who've done this work already or are doing it currently to help guide us. Each one of our pillars, health, education, aid, and leadership, is going to be guided by an advisory board of volunteer experts in those fields, mainly from the Palestinian community, to ensure that the models that we're utilizing, the programs and projects that we're initiating, and the monitoring and evaluation of those programs is being done in the best way. And I think that's how we've been most effective in the health over the past many years. And I think we can do that in the other pillars as well.
if we do have listeners that are very much interested in being part of this volunteer leadership advisory committee that you are looking at recruiting, what are the best ways to do that? And what are you looking for?
We're looking for, first of all, in the mentorship program, anybody can sign up for that, because eventually when you have 30,000 kids who are injured, it's a scale issue right now. So we're just building in the early stages of building the platform that will be able to manage effectively such a large initiative. But certainly there's space for everybody to be involved. And in an organization that's a grassroots organization, I mean, there's a role for everybody who wants to organize events in their communities, who wants to help with the kids that we bring out for medical care, who wants to go, for doctors to volunteer on missions, for educators to help become tutors or guide us in developing education programs, for people who are involved in humanitarian relief or want to raise money for us to feed people in Gaza during this crisis of starvation and food deprivation, for people who want to become mentors or want to be part of the leadership program or want to take responsibility for one child's life and help guide that child over the next 5, 10, 15 years to become independent. There's a role and space for everybody in our organization. We're growing. We just founded. We're only 6 weeks old, not even 6 weeks old yet. So we do ask that people be a little bit patient, but part of this growth is also people coming in and helping guide us. This is an organization for everyone. It's not my organization. It's for the Palestinian people. It's going to be led by the Palestinian people. I'm here as a implementer, somebody who takes the leadership, the advice of people who know better than me in the areas that they're experts in, and then implement those programs based on what's best for the need, what's based on the needs on the ground, and what's best for the people that we're serving, and based on what resources we have available. Did that answer your question?
It did. It answered exactly. My question and
Sorry.
Much, much more.
Go off on tangent.
It's okay. Relax. One of the things I appreciate you making a note of is that this is a very, very long journey.
Yeah.
And we do have our priorities today. And I think one of the biggest misconceptions around donations is that everyone thinks people are donating enough. And a lot of people have questions around where this money is being donated to. One of the priority issues that I noticed on the HEAL platform now has to do with getting children out of Gaza that require very specific medical attention.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the dire immediate needs around evacuating specific medical cases and food within Gaza?
Yeah, well, those are two great questions and two very critical areas. So when the health system collapsed, and it's been in difficult circumstances for years, don't forget the siege in Gaza started in 2006 and has affected the health system significantly. And one thing we didn't talk about when we spoke about PCRF is some of the major accomplishments we had over the years, which was building a cancer department in Gaza, for example, and the number of children who no longer had to travel abroad from cancer treatment were now being treated inside Gaza. So that department's shut down. So, you know, we were fortunate through the hard work of so many people led by my wife, Dr. Zina Salman, who's a pediatric oncologist. We've been able to get over 40 cancer kids out for treatment that they otherwise wouldn't get. Now, you might think that's a small number, but there aren't that many kids with cancer in Gaza. So that's a significant number. And those kids are getting free treatment in places, well, that's getting sponsored treatment, free in the sense that their families aren't paying, in places like Egypt and Jordan, where the quality of care is suitable for what their needs are. But the whole point is that the whole health system's is collapsed. So not only are there, we've seen 30,000 injuries, we've seen nearly 12,000 children killed, which is over 1% of the entire population of children in Gaza have been killed in the last 4 months, but a huge number, 3 to 4% of the population of children have been injured. And as I mentioned, we're not talking about the psychological trauma, which is an injury in itself, but just children who've suffered physical injuries. And the vast majority of them need medical care that they can't get locally because all of the hospitals are not functioning except for the European Gaza Hospital, and that's at over 300% capacity. So Shifa Hospital, the main hospital in Gaza, is shut down for the most part. It serves basically as a clinic now, as a triage center. It doesn't have any real functioning services. We were building, by the way, in Shifa Hospital, a transplant program. The Indonesian hospital near Jabalia in northern Gaza, we had just finished 4 operating theaters, had brand new, we're ready to open them and operate. That hospital shut down. You go down to the Al-Aqsa Hospital and Nasser Hospital, Al-Aqsa and Deir al-Balah, on the brink of being shut down, but certainly not providing any kind of significant services to those who are in dire need. So on and so forth. I can go through the long list of hospitals in Gaza. I know all of them. I've worked in all of them. The doctors there are true heroes, as are the nurses. But the health system's collapsed. So every one of these kids need to come out. Now, the challenge is getting them out, because you do not just go to the border to Egypt and cross. You have to be on a list. And the process of getting on the list these days is very challenging. It's not clear or transparent how people get on the list. In some cases, the child might get on the list without their parents. We have actually a baby right now that's dying from congenital heart disease, who's on a list to be evacuated. We have a hospital waiting for him, but his mom's not on the list, or his father. So how's this baby going to go to Egypt for surgery that he needs to save his life when his parents aren't on the list as well? So it's an extremely complicated and challenging issue. We have plenty of kids that we are currently arranging free medical care in the U.S. and other places. We hope to bring them to the UAE as well, Dubai. But the challenge is getting them out. And that's really the most significant issue that we're facing right now. In addition to that, you mentioned the issue of food. We are able, with our team on the ground, to find through the different markets that are available in Gaza, food that we can then, as I mentioned before, cook and provide free to people who are in dire need, mostly children on the ground in the different displaced areas of Gaza. And that's really the top priority right now, because starvation is a real issue in Gaza.
I'm so sorry. No. I look at you, Steve, and I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful for what you do. I'm so grateful for what you've been doing. But you have no idea how difficult it is. Knowing that you had a chance to help in a way that my father probably wouldn't be able to. And neither would I at this point. But I'm relying, and I'm staying as committed as possible I am to the belief in the good that exists, in what I have seen come from this awakening. At a very unfair cost, but I have to acknowledge that there has been an awakening, and I'm so, so eternally grateful to people like you and this specific initiative. If I were to ask you what message you'd like to send to our audience about what is going on, because I think one of the things I do want to leave people with is that their voice matters, their donations matter, their actions matter, and we've gotten too far to give up or to get angry or to stay angry or stay resentful. What can we leave our audience with?
Well, I think the biggest challenge we face right now is a community that's watching a genocide in front of our face every day. We're watching the killing of hundreds of children, and the killing and injuring of hundreds of children every single day. We're seeing fathers claw at dirt to find their children buried under rubble. We see doctors collapse from exhaustion and amputating patients' legs and limbs without anesthesia. We're seeing physicians unable to use antiseptics to sterilize instruments, and medieval medical care being now applied to our innocent children in Gaza. We're witnessing this as human beings with feelings, with emotions, with and the most dangerous thing for us, I feel, is to allow this absolute crime against humanity, against these innocent children, against our brothers and sisters, to turn us into angry, vengeful, hateful people. And that's not an easy thing, because everything that's happening is completely conjures up emotions that are not healthy for any human being to carry inside of them. What I hope our community can always remind ourselves is that these emotions, as human as we are, need to be channeled into some positive action. The worst thing we can do, the thing that they want us to do, is to become vengeful and hateful. That one day we'll be blocking the border, where starving children are on the other side of a wall, and prevent trucks of food reaching these starving children. We're never going to be like that. And we're not going to allow ourselves to be like that. What we're going to do from this terrible genocide, which is unfolding every single day in front of our eyes, is show the people their love, compassion, and solidarity, and rise up and stand with them. And not just through actions, which is fine on social media and what have you. Okay, share information, like it, but let's act. Children without legs deserve medical care. Burned kids who have endured the loss of their parents deserve love and compassion the rest of their lives. We have to commit ourselves to actions of healing and love, and not turn to the dark side of hatred and anger, and even worse than that. We're better than that. that's what they want us to do. We're not going to go that way. We're going to go the alternative way, which is stand in solidarity and act in love and compassion and heal our children and show them that their lives matter and we've not abandoned them. We're not giving up. And we're going to continue the struggle until the people of Palestine are free.
Amen to that. Steve, thank you so much for coming. I know you, this is a very short trip. I know you're visiting multiple countries and you're around. So I really appreciate you making the time to come join us for this episode.
It's my pleasure. If I can just say one more thing, I don't want anyone to ever thank me for what I do. It's an honor and a privilege to serve the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause. And, you know, I went through in my life the loss of my first wife, who was an amazing Palestinian woman. She was strong, smart, funny, and the most probably humane person I knew. And she made me a much better person than I ever would have been without her. And she had so much courage. She married an American guy out of, following her heart in Palestine, which is not an easy thing to do back during the First Intifada. And when I lost her, the grief, overwhelming grief that I felt, the only way I was able to get through the loss of my wife, God bless her soul, Huda al-Masri, was to channel that grief into serving the Palestinian people. And that's the way I healed as a person, as a man, as a spirit, whatever we are. And it's because I had the Palestinian cause, because I had the people to serve, something greater than myself, I was able to recover and become a you know, whole again, as much as one can. And therefore, don't ever thank me. I have to thank the Palestinians for giving me that opportunity. So just have to say that at the end.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Allah yarhamaha.
Thank you.
Thank you all, as always, for the privilege of your time. I'll be sure to add any of the links that we have referenced today to either donate or volunteer to be part of the advisory board for the HEAL organization. I will also make sure to add all of Steve's social media links, which I assume is the best way to connect with you if people are interested
sure.
in doing so.
Yeah.
Okay, great. As always, I hope you found something to consider.